Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 118.
Imagine you're born into a family that is just unfathomably wealthy.
Right, like wealth on a scale that's hard to even picture today.
Exactly. I mean, your ancestors literally used silver to buy government positions.
Yeah, they literally bought their way into the ruling class.
And your biggest daily concern, you know, as a kid growing up in this environment, is composing the perfect line of poetry.
Or deciding which silk robe matches the blossoms in your private garden, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just total insulated luxury. But now, imagine waking up one morning to find out that your uncles, the men who taught you to revere family honor, are actively scheming to sell your young niece to a foreign warlord.
Just to pay off yesterday's gambling debts, it's incredibly dark.
It is. Your fortune is totally gone. The people you trusted are turning into predators right in front of you.
Yeah.
So today, you know, we are essentially watching an empire burn from the inside out.
It's a terrifying premise, but it is precisely the reality we are examining today. We're looking at a society in total freefall.
And that really brings us to the core mission for you, the listener. We are stepping into this incredibly dense, just brutally revealing excerpt from Chapter 118 of the monumental Chinese classic, Dream of the Red Chamber.
Also known as Hong Lu Meng.
Right. And, you know, we aren't just reading a novel today. We are using this text as a kind of laboratory.
A social laboratory.
Exactly. Yeah. To answer a really fundamental human question. What do people actually do when the structural bedrock of their entire reality collapses?
And to truly grasp the stakes here, I mean, we have to understand the architecture of the Jia family before we watch it crumble.
Because it's not just a rich family losing money, right?
No, not at all. The Jia state is a microcosm of the imperial state itself. It operates on this really rigid hierarchy of Confucian duty, filial piety, and absolute obedience to seniority.
So basically, your position in the family dictates your worth.
Your worth, your future, your daily reality, everything. But in this specific snapshot we're looking at, the structural integrity of that hierarchy is just failing entirely.
Yeah, I mean, they are hemorrhaging money. The matriarch has died. Political favor has evaporated.
Yet the masters are still desperately panting through this performance of aristocracy.
It's performative survival. They're trying to enforce the rules of a game that literally no longer exists.
That's a great way to put it.
And I think the most visceral place to start is with someone who looks at this failing system and just decides to completely opt out.
Oh, definitely. You're talking about Shichun.
Right, Shichun. She's one of the young women of the noble house, and she decides to build her own escape pod, basically, by announcing she is going to become a nun.
And Shichun's decision is an absolute structural earthquake for this family.
Because, I mean, in our modern context, if a young adult from a prominent family decides to join a monastery, it might be viewed as eccentric, right?
Yeah, maybe a bit extreme or unconventional.
But in the world of the Jia family, a daughter of the house becoming a Buddhist ascetic is a catastrophic loss of social capital.
Oh, absolutely. Because her purpose in this machine is to be married off.
Right. To consolidate power with another noble family.
Exactly. Her body and her future are assets belonging to the lineage. And furthermore, the philosophy she is embracing, Buddhism, demands the severing of all earthly attachments.
Which is basically the opposite of what they want.
It is a direct, hostile rejection of the Confucian ideal. Because Confucianism demands lifelong devotion to your parents and ancestors.
So to leave the secular world is to basically declare that the family's entire value system is spiritually bankrupt.
Yes, it's a massive insult.
So predictably, the elder women of the family, specifically Wang Furen and Xing Furen, they just launch into total crisis management.
Total panic mode. They weep, they beg, they try to throw the brakes on this whole thing.
But Shichun is just stone cold resolute. I mean, she has looked at the rot in her family and she refuses to participate anymore.
She's totally done.
Yeah. So the elders, realizing they can't physically force her to change her mind, construct this bizarre compromise.
This is where it gets really fascinating.
Right. So Wang Furen tells Shichun, essentially, that she can practice her religion, but with conditions.
Strict conditions.
Yeah. First, she doesn't have to leave the estate to go to some harsh, remote monastery. She could just use her current luxurious bedroom as her quote-unquote quiet room.
Which kind of defeats the purpose of an ascetic retreat.
Exactly. And second, and this is the most important part, Wang Furen insists that Shichun must not shave her head.
Now, that stipulation about the hair That reveals the underlying mechanics of this society.
Because hair is a big deal, right?
Huge. Hair is not cosmetic here. It is an incredibly potent legal and social tether. The ancient text, the classic of filial piety, explicitly states that your body, hair, and skin are received from your parents.
And you must not dare to injure them.
Exactly. To shave your head is to commit a profound act of social severance. It announces to the world that you no longer belong to your bloodline.
Wow. So I look at Wang Furen's compromise and I refuse to view it as maternal accommodation.
Oh, it's definitely not.
No. This is entirely about brand management. It feels like a corporate PR move.
That's exactly what it is.
By keeping Xuchun in her bedroom and keeping her hair intact, Wang Furen is neutralizing the visual threat of the rebellion.
Right. She's controlling the optics.
Yeah. She is telling Xuchun she can, you know, play at being a nun as long as an outsider walking past the window still sees a perfectly coiffed aristocratic daughter. It completely domesticates the spiritual exit.
You are hitting on the exact mechanism of control, and Wang Furen even cites a precedent to justify this.
Oh, right, the other nun.
Yes, Miao Yu, a nun who resided in the family's garden previously. Wang Furen argues, you know, look at Miao Yu. She kept her hair, and she still harbored mortal desires.
The implication there is just stunning.
It really is. Wang Furen isn't trying to facilitate Xichun's spiritual journey at all. She is actively hoping to sabotage it.
Because she wants Xichun to retain those mortal desires.
Exactly. Which, in this context, means a lingering psychological attachment to the family's status and wealth.
She is literally trying to keep the escape pod tethered to the main ship.
That's a perfect analogy.
But, you know, think about what this reveals about the absolute lack of mobility for women in this era. Xichun sees the walls closing in. She sees the corruption.
But she has nowhere to go.
Right. If she were a man, maybe she could travel, maybe take a post in a distant province. But as a woman, her only socially recognized exit strategy is religious devotion.
And even then, the family steps in.
Yeah, they try to zone her spiritual life into a corner of the house so it doesn't disturb their optics. It's just wild.
It is a suffocating reality.
Oh.
The social structure permits no unapproved vacuums.
Yeah.
Even when Xichun successfully establishes this boundary, retiring to her room to chant sutras and ignore the outside world, her withdrawal immediately creates a logistical vacuum.
Right, a vacuum that forces the people below her to make some really terrible choices.
Yes, because a noble daughter, even one who claims to have renounced the world, cannot simply fetch her own water and cook her own meals.
God forbid, right?
Exactly. The machinery of the estate demands that she have a staff. So the elders summon the maids to figure out who is going to be assigned to serve Xichun in her new, austere, joyless existence.
And I mean, put yourself in the position of these maids. Their lives are defined by their proximity to power, favor, and resources within the household.
Serving a young, favored master or mistress means access to better food, occasional gifts, a slight buffer against arbitrary punishment.
Yeah, it's a relatively cushy gig compared to the alternative.
Right. But serving someone who has sworn off all earthly pleasures, someone who will spend her days in silent prayer, and who offers absolutely zero path for social advancement within the estate.
It is a career death sentence.
Utterly.
So you can almost hear the crickets in the room when Wang Furen asks for volunteers. The majority of the maids resort to this ultimate bureaucratic defense mechanism.
They do. A maid named Kaping speaks for the group.
And she delivers this perfectly neutral, non-committal response, right? Something like, whoever the mistresses assign, we will follow.
It is a masterclass in risk avoidance. Kaping is relying on the inertia of the hierarchy.
She is projecting total obedience to mask her absolute desperation not to be chosen.
Exactly. She throws the decision back to the authorities, hoping the statistical odds will just spare her.
But then, a maid named Ziwan breaks ranks.
Yes.
He steps forward, kneels before Wang Furen, and explicitly asks for the assignment. And she doesn't just ask to serve Xichun temporarily. She commits to this austere life permanently.
And her reasoning is what makes this so profound.
Right. Because when asked why, she delivers a speech that completely sidelines the religious context.
She doesn't mention Buddhism at all.
No. She explains that she is doing this out of devotion to her former mistress, Lin Daiyu, who recently died.
Right.
Ziwan says Daiyu's kindness was as heavy as a mountain, and she wishes she could have followed Daiyu into death.
But she can't, because her body belongs to the master's household.
Exactly. She cannot end her own life. So she chooses the closest equivalent. She will serve the ascetic Xichun, effectively ending her social existence to honor her grief.
This is a staggering moment of psychological complexity. I mean, to understand Zihuan's action, we really have to look at the mechanics of servitude.
Because it's brutal.
It is. A maid in this environment is legally property. She is subject to the emotional volatility of the masters. She is constantly vulnerable to sexual predation by the male relatives.
Yeah, that's a huge danger.
And she can be sold off or married to a stranger at a moment's notice to serve the family's interests. She has zero structural agency over her physical person.
So this brings up a huge question for me. Is this genuinely an act of pure selfless loyalty, or is Zihuan executing an incredibly strategic maneuver?
It's a great question.
Because to me, it looks like she's looking at the board, seeing that the family is collapsing into absolute chaos, and she finds the one corner of the estate that is socially untouchable.
The nun's room.
Right. By attaching herself to Shichun's religious exile, isn't she effectively pulling herself out of the firing line? She removes herself from the marriage market, the gossip, and the predatory uncles.
I think it is both. And that is why it is so profound. The genius of Zihuan's move is that she uses the master's own awkwardness regarding Shichun against them.
Oh, that's so true. The elders are baffled by Shichun's asceticism.
They don't know how to handle it at all. So Zihuan steps into that confusion and volunteers to solve their administrative problem.
And by doing so, she secures a perimeter for herself.
Exactly. Yes, it is a strategic retreat from the brutal politics of the maids' quarters, but it is deeply fueled by her need to protect her internal emotional life.
She is transforming a compulsory, degrading status servitude into a voluntary, lifelong act of personal devotion to Dayu's memory.
She is weaponizing her lack of power.
She realizes that no one in authority wants to look too closely at the quote-unquote nun's room.
Mm-hmm.
So she uses it as a shield to grieve in peace.
And think about how this resonates today for anyone listening.
Yeah, if you've ever found yourself trapped in a rigid, uncaring institution.
When you have no power to change the rules, sometimes the only way to reclaim your humanity is to find a blind spot in this system and claim it for yourself.
Zihuan is an emotional survivalist.
Absolutely. And notice Wang Furen's reaction to this. The matriarch is genuinely perplexed.
She doesn't get it at all, does she?
No. She cannot comprehend why someone would voluntarily choose hardship if they weren't forced to by the hierarchy. The masters operate purely on an axis of dominance and submission.
Right.
The idea of intrinsic, uncoerced emotional loyalty is completely foreign to them at this stage of their moral decay.
Which perfectly sets up our next massive shift in the text. Because while a lowly servant is demonstrating this profound depth of character, the actual masters of the estate, the people who supposedly embody Confucian virtue, are out in the world proving that their entire identity was nothing more than an illusion funded by endless cash.
And to see that, we have to travel south with the patriarch of the family, Jia Zheng.
Yeah, the narrative takes us away from the claustrophobia of the women's quarters and onto the Grand Canal.
Jia Zheng is fulfilling his most sacred duty, escorting the coffin of his mother, the late grandmother Jia, to the ancestral burial grounds in the south.
And this is an operation of massive logistical and symbolic importance.
Mm.
I mean, to picture this for you listening, don't imagine a quiet hearse.
No, not at all.
This is a massive flotilla. They have boats for the coffin, boats for the relatives, boats for the servants, and boats for the guards.
It is a floating city designed to project the Jia family's untouchable prestige to every province they pass through.
But of course they hit a snag. The waterways are congested with military vessels returning from a frontier campaign.
And the military always has right of way.
Right, so Jia Zing's grand procession is forced to pull over and wait.
And this delay exposes a critical structural flaw. Jia Zheng has run out of money.
Which is just wild to think about.
Well, the daily operating costs of this flotilla are astronomical, and the family's wealth at the capital has already been hollowed out.
So here is the patriarch of one of the highest-ranking families in the empire, stranded on a riverbank, entirely illiquid.
He needs a bailout. So Jia Zheng writes a letter to a man named Lai Shengrong.
Now, we have to look very closely at the power dynamics here because this is fascinating. Lai Shengrong is the current magistrate of a nearby county.
He has actual administrative power and a steady income.
Right. But generationally, the Lai family were servants to the Jia family.
Yes. Decades ago, when the Jias were flush with cash and influence, they pulled strings to buy a government post for the son of their servant.
And that son is Lai Shengrong.
Precisely. So in Jia Zheng's mind, the social ledger is clear. The Jia family created Lai Shengrong. Therefore, Lai Shengrong owes them eternal fealty.
So Jia Xiang sends a messenger with a letter requesting 500 taels of silver to tide him over. Let's contextualize this amount, though. In this era, 500 taels is a small fortune.
It could likely buy an entire state in the countryside.
Wow. So it is not casual pocket money.
No. But Jia Xiang isn't asking for a loan in the modern sense. He is demanding a dividend on a generational investment.
He is calling in a chit based on an assumed eternal hierarchy where the Jia master commands and the Lai servant provides.
But the messenger returns from the magistrate's office with a devastating reality check.
Oh, this part is amazing. Lai Shangrong writes a letter complaining about poor harvests, complaining about the difficulties of his post, essentially giving a long sob story about how broke he is.
And he sends back 50 taels.
50 taels, exactly one-tenth of the request.
This is an economic margin call. Lai Shangrong is looking at the political landscape. He knows the Jia family is in terminal decline in the capital. He knows they are losing favor with the emperor.
So the 50 taels is not a genuine attempt to help.
Not at all. It is a calculated insult. It is a severance package. He is signaling to Jia Zhang that the old social contract is null and void.
The servant has become the master of his own capital, and the master is now just a beggar with a famous last name.
Exactly.
You know, I look at this exchange, and it feels exactly like a scenario you might see in a modern corporate collapse.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine a guy who is the CEO of an untouchable, monopolistic tech giant 20 years ago. The company went bankrupt, he lost everything, but he still carries himself with immense arrogance.
Right. He still acts like he owns the world.
Yeah. So he's stranded at an airport after his credit cards are declined, and he calls up his former intern, a kid he used to berate for bringing the wrong coffee, but who is now the founder of a billion-dollar startup.
I love this analogy.
The former CEO says, you know, I need a $50,000 personal loan, wire it immediately. And the former intern sends him a $50 Uber gift card with a note saying, hope this helps you get home.
That is brutal.
But it's true. The insult isn't that $50 is useless. The insult is the brutal clarification of exactly where they both stand now.
A perfect parallel. The Uber gift card strips the CEO of his delusion, and Jia Zhang reacts exactly as a wounded patriarch would.
He totally loses it.
He does not swallow his pride and use the 50 taels to buy provisions for his stranded servants. He flies into a rage, orders the messenger to take the silver and the letter directly back to Lai Shangrong, and utterly refuses it.
He would literally rather sit on a boat and starve next to his mother's decaying corpse than accept what he views as a peasant throwing him a bone.
His pride is the only asset he hasn't liquidated.
But here is the mechanism I find truly fascinating. When the messenger dumps the 50 taels back on Lai Shangrong's desk, Lai doesn't laugh. He doesn't say, fine, starve.
No, he goes into absolute panic mode.
Why? I mean, he has the money. He has the government position. The Jia family is broke. Why is he terrified of Jia Zhang's rejection?
Because Lai Shangrong understands the residual radioactive half-life of political reputation.
Okay, unpack that a bit.
Well, the Jia family's bank accounts might be empty, but their network in the capital is ancient and vast. They still possess aristocratic titles. Lai realizes that by insulting Jia Zhang, he might have triggered a spiteful reflex. Jia Zhang is stranded now, but if he manages to write a single letter to a high-ranking friend in the imperial court, he could easily have a minor county magistrate like Lai stripped of his post, audited, or exiled.
So the whole power structure is just a hologram fueled by mutual paranoia.
That's exactly what it is.
Lai Shangrong is terrified of a ghost. And to protect himself from the phantom wrath of the Jia family, Lai immediately writes a frantic letter to his own father in the capital, begging him to resign his post, citing a fake illness.
He would rather give up entire career than risk the vengeance of a broke old man.
It demonstrates that in a declining system, the fear of consequences outlasts an actual ability to enforce them.
Both men are operating on delusions. Jia Zhang believes he is still a commanding lord. Lai Shangrong believes Jia Zhang is still a lethal threat.
Neither is true.
But the friction between those two delusions dictates their reality.
And as we will see, this tension between the illusion of power and the brutal reality of having no resources is exactly what causes the morality of the family back home to completely implode.
Because while Jia Zhang is playing these hollow power games on the river, the relatives left managing the estate decide they need capital.
And they don't care whose life they have to destroy to get it.
This brings us to the darkest, most irredeemable subplot in the entire text.
Yeah, this is where it gets incredibly grim.
The estate is bleeding money. The debts are mounting. Three men of the family, Jia Yun, Jia Huan, and Wang Ren, uncles and cousins to the main bloodline.
They concoct a scheme to generate both wealth and political leverage.
And they target a vulnerable young member of the family, Kiaoji.
And let's be incredibly clear about the mechanics of what they are plotting here. They are not arranging a strategic marriage to another noble family.
No.
They are arranging to sell a legitimate daughter of the Jia bloodline as a concubine to an outer vassal prince, essentially a foreign warlord from the border regions.
They are engaging in human trafficking to clear their balance sheets.
It is the absolute collapse of the Confucian mandate.
Completely. The primary duty of the elders is to protect and elevate the lineage. Instead, they are cannibalizing their own future.
They do it by exploiting the structural absence of authority.
Yes. Qiaoji's father, Jia Lian, is away from the estate.
So the highest-ranking authority figure present is Xing Furen, who is Qiaoji's grandmother.
Now, the text often portrays Xing Furen as foolish, easily manipulated, and historically sidelined from the real power in the house.
Right. So the three men bring the proposal to her, but they dress it up in the language of duty. They pitch it as a quote-unquote glorious match.
They tell her, this foreign prince is incredibly rich. If we give him Qiaoji, he will use his influence at court to restore your husband's official rank.
And Xing Furen agrees to it. Now, I have a major problem with how some people read this scene, framing Xing Furen as just a naive victim of these men's lies.
You don't buy it.
I refuse to believe she is that gullible. I mean, she is an aristocratic woman who has spent decades navigating the vicious politics of this household. She absolutely knows the difference between a proper, dignified marriage arranged with matchmakers and quietly selling a child as a concubine to a foreigner.
That's a very fair point.
To me, she is willfully blinding herself. She is looking at the price tag, the restoration of her husband's rank, which elevates her own status, and she calculates that trading the little girl's life is worth it.
The glorious match pitch is just the polite fiction she needs to sleep at night.
Exactly.
And your assessment aligns perfectly with the psychological underpinnings of systemic corruption. Xing Furen is historically resentful of her lack of power compared to the other matriarchs.
She wants to be the boss.
Right. Suddenly, these men present her with an opportunity to be the savior of her specific branch of the family, to act as the supreme decision maker.
And the promise of prestige acts as an anesthetic to her conscience.
Acknowledging the truth that she is sanctioning the sale of her step-granddaughter into sexual slavery would shatter her self-image. So she violently embraces the delusion that it is a strategic marriage.
But the truly terrifying part is the reaction of the people in the house who do see reality clearly.
Wang Furen and Ping Er.
Right. Wang Furen, the other matriarch and Ping Er, are fiercely loyal maid to Kaoji's family. They both realize exactly what is happening. They know it is a catastrophic moral crime. But they do nothing to stop it.
And here we must examine the paralyzing mechanics of Confucian hierarchy. Why does Wang Furen, a woman who wields significant influence, stand by and weep while a child is trafficked?
It's because of the seniority rules, isn't it?
Yes, because Xing Furen is the wife of the elder brother. In the strict legal and social code of the family, seniority dictates absolute authority over familial matters in the absence of the patriarchs.
This is the structural prison we are talking about. The rulebook itself has become the weapon. Wang Furen is basically looking at a house fire, watching someone throw a child into the flames, and saying, well, the arsonist is technically my senior sister-in-law, so it would be a violation of protocol to grab the fire extinguisher.
It forces us to ask a horrifying question. What happens when doing the objectively right thing fundamentally requires you to violate the foundational laws of your entire universe?
You just freeze.
For Wang Furen to actively intervene and stop Xing Furen, she would have to openly rebel against the core tenet of Confucian seniority. She is too deeply embedded in that ideological matrix to break the code, even to save a life.
The system is designed to demand obedience over morality.
It truly is.
And to ground this in how visceral and sickening this reality is, the text gives us a scene that strips away all the polite, bureaucratic language of the scheme. The conspirators arrange a quote-unquote viewing.
This scene is so hard to read.
It really is. The foreign prince sends a delegation of his women to the Jia estate to essentially inspect the merchandise.
And the physical staging of the scene is crucial. These foreign women, dressed in unfamiliar, flashy garments, enter the inner sanctum of the aristocratic household, a place usually sealed off from outsiders.
And they approach young Kiyoji. They don't speak to her respectfully. They look her up and down. They grab her hands to examine her skin.
They are assessing her physical viability exactly as a buyer would inspect a horse at an auction.
And Kiyoji, who is just a child raised in extreme seclusion and modesty, is left entirely confused and profoundly humiliated.
That moment grounds the abstract villainy in undeniable bodily reality. The abstract, glorious match dissolves into the tactile reality of flesh being appraised for currency.
It is the final, undeniable proof that the Gia family's claim to moral superiority is completely dead.
Absolutely dead.
And as we watch this absolute collapse of morality unfold, we have to look at how the central protagonist of the entire novel, Bayou, is reacting to the chaos.
Bayou is such a complex figure here.
Because Bayou is watching the exact same collapse we are, but his reaction is so entirely outside the norm that his family assumes he has lost his mind.
Bayou's internal journey is perhaps the most intellectually demanding part of the text. To contextualize his mindset, let's look back at his initial reaction to Shichun announcing she was becoming a nun.
Right.
When the rest of the family was panicking and crying over Shichun, Bayou's reaction was deeply unsettling to them. He laughed out loud.
And then, amidst the crisis, he recited a poem.
He did.
It is such a classically infuriating Bayou move to drop a poem in the middle of a disaster. But the poem is a tactical strike. He recites, "See through the brief spring, its scenery won't last. The dark robes of a nun suddenly replace the makeup of yesteryear. Pitiable is the daughter of a marquis in her embroidered chamber, sleeping alone beside the blue lamp in ancient Buddha."
See through the brief spring, that line is the key. Bayou is diagnosing the terminal illness of his family. He isn't laughing at Shichun. He is laughing at the absurdity of the family's shock.
They just don't get it.
He understands that Shichun's retreat is not an isolated tragedy, but the inevitable conclusion of their hollow, unsustainable existence. The spring is over. The winter of consequence is here.
But the people around him refuse to hear the diagnosis. His wife, Bao Chai, and his sister-in-law, Li Wan, listen to him recite this poem, and they are horrified.
They don't analyze his words. They pathologize him. They say he's entered a state of delusion.
They diagnose his clarity as a psychiatric break.
He is suffering from a Cassandra complex. He sees the structural doom clearly. He articulates it perfectly. And because his truth contradicts the required social delusion, he is treated as a madman.
But the world doesn't allow him to just sit in his room reciting prophetic poetry. The machinery of the state intrudes.
It always does.
A letter arrives from Ji Zheng, the very same patriarch currently stranded on a boat refusing 50 taels. The letter demands that Bayou and his young nephew, Jialan, must immediately begin rigorous study for the upcoming Imperial Civil Service examinations.
This command from the patriarch sets the stage for a massive ideological war within Bayou's chambers. It initiates a philosophical duel between Bayou and his wife, Bao Chai, that represents the central intellectual conflict of the entire era.
Bao Chai walks into the room, armed with generations of social expectation, and she finds Bayou casually reading the Zhuangzi, a foundational text of Taoist philosophy that essentially advocates for wandering freely and rejecting societal ambition.
She sits down, and the battle lines are drawn.
And to understand the stakes of this debate, we really have to meticulously break down the mechanics of the two worldviews colliding here.
Yes. Bao Chai is the avatar of Orthodox Confucianism. Her entire argument is predicated on duty, utility, and the repayment of debt.
She argues that true human virtue is not found in reading mystical texts or seeking personal spiritual enlightenment. Virtue is exclusively found in public action.
She invokes the names of the ancient mythical sage kings, Yao and Shun.
She points to these legendary figures and essentially says they didn't become saints by sitting in a garden analyzing their feelings. They became saints because they governed, they relieved the suffering of the common people, and they brought order to the world.
Precisely. For Bao Chai, moral worth is entirely defined by your utility to the state and to your ancestors.
Now, I'm going to push back hard here, because modern readers often reflexively side with Bao Yu as the misunderstood artist. But if you strip away the ancient terminology, Bao Chai's argument is devastatingly rational.
It really is.
She is looking at her husband and saying, "Bao Yu, you have been clothed in the finest silks and fed on exotic delicacies since the day you were born. You have never worked a day in your life. This family, the ancestors, the labor of thousands of peasants, they funded your existence. And now the family is drowning. The estate is bankrupt. We are at risk of losing everything.
You owe us."
Exactly. You owe us a return on the investment we made in you. Your duty is to pass this exam, get a government salary, and save the people who raised you. I think she is absolutely right. If he refuses to work when the family is starving, he isn't a spiritual genius. He's just a parasite using high-minded philosophy to dodge his responsibilities.
Your defense of Bao Chai is exactly what gives this text its enduring power. It refuses to offer a simple villain. From a utilitarian survivalist standpoint, Bao Chai's logic is unassailable. The family needs an income, and passing the exam is the only legal way for an aristocrat to generate one.
So how does Bao Yu respond to that?
Oh, we must examine the mechanics of Bao Yu's counter-argument. He counters her demands with a synthesis of Taoist and Buddhist ideals. He doesn't deny the existence of Yao and Shun, but he argues for the concept of the Qizhiziqi, the pure heart of a child.
Okay, so what does that mean in this context?
Bao Yu argues that the moment a person enters the bureaucratic machine of ambition, they are forced to sacrifice their humanity.
Because the system itself is what is corrupt. I mean, think about what passing this exam actually means. It doesn't mean Bao Yu gets to go be a noble hero. It means he gets to join the ranks of officials like Lai Shangrong, the men who hoard wealth, trade favors, and let old men starve on rivers.
Yes.
It means joining the power structure that is currently looking the other way, while uncles sell his niece to a warlord.
Exactly. Bao Yu recognizes that to succeed in Bao Chai's world requires spiritual death. He tells her that the pursuit of officialdom traps a person in the three poisons of Buddhism, greed, anger, and ignorance.
He sees that the quote-unquote success Bao Chai is begging him to achieve is merely the privilege of becoming a well-dressed monster.
He views the exam not as a test of knowledge, but as an initiation ritual into a fundamentally diseased system.
The physical dynamic of this debate is just so striking to me. Bao Chai is pleading. She is leveraging guilt, history, and logic. She is talking endlessly. And at the climax of her argument, what does Bao Yu do? The text notes that he simply looks up and smiles silently.
He doesn't scream back. He just smiles.
Yeah, that silence is just, it's so loaded.
That silence is the realization of absolute alienation. Bao Yu understands, in that moment, that they are operating on fundamentally incompatible operating systems. Bao Chai genuinely believes that the social order is reality.
And Bao Yu.
Bao Yu has come to the profound realization that the social order is a violent, temporary illusion. You cannot use logic to argue someone out of an illusion if they don't even know they are inside it.
I think about how this translates to anyone listening to us right now. How many of you feel the crushing weight of a Bao Chai in your life? Whether it's a parent, a spouse, or just societal pressure demanding that you achieve a specific type of success.
It's a very common feeling.
You must get the prestigious degree. You must climb the corporate ladder. You must buy the expensive house because that is how you prove your worth. And you might look at that ladder and realize that every rung requires you to compromise your morals, to abandon your passions, to work yourself into exhaustion for a company that would lay you off tomorrow.
The tension between the obligation to survive in the system and the desperate need to protect your own soul is universal.
It is the eternal conflict of the individual versus the institution.
Mm.
And the pressure on Bao Yu is not isolated to Bao Chai, is it?
No, his primary maid, Shirin, enters the fray as well. She uses a different tactic emotional blackmail. She reminds him of how hard the servants labor to keep him comfortable, implying that his refusal to take the exam is a betrayal of the lower classes who depend on him.
So he is completely cornered.
Completely.
Which makes his next move so incredibly shocking. We have just witnessed Bao Yu eloquently dismantle the morality of ambition. We know he views the bureaucratic system as a trap of greed and ignorance, and yet the debate abruptly ends because Bao Yu surrenders. He suddenly gives in.
He capitulates, but the specific wording of this capitulation is paramount. Bao Chai, exhausted, makes one final compromised plea. She says, essentially, if you truly hate the idea of being an official, fine, but at least take the exam to get the degree. Just get the piece of paper to not waste heavenly grace and ancestral virtue, and then you can stop there. It would be enough to clear the family's name.
And Bao Yu physically reacts to those words, to stop there. He nods, he sighs, and he says, getting a degree isn't really that hard. But your phrase, from then on to stop there, not wasting heavenly grace and ancestral virtue, that doesn't depart from the core principle.
We must dissect the psychology of this pivot. Bao Yu has not been persuaded by the virtue of Confucianism. He has found a technical loophole in their demands.
Loophole?
Yes. He calculates that he can never win the philosophical argument. They will never stop hounding him, weeping at him, and making him feel guilty. The only way to permanently free himself is to pay the ransom.
He is going to buy his way out. It's chilling when you watch his behavior immediately following this conversation, because he doesn't sulk. He transforms into the perfect, compliant student.
He orders his maids to pack away all his beloved texts, the Zhuangzi, the Buddhist sutras, the books that constitute his actual identity. He demands a quiet room.
When his young nephew, Jia Lan, comes in with study materials, Bao Yu cheerfully sits down and starts debating the structure of the rigid eight-legged essays required for the exam.
To Bao Chai and Jiren, this looks like a miraculous cure. They are overjoyed. They believe the rebellious teenager has finally matured into a responsible patriarch. They believe they have saved him.
But they haven't saved him. They have lost him entirely. He is putting on a mask. I see this behavior all the time in modern work environments. It is the absolute epitome of quiet quitting, but taken to an existential extreme.
How do you mean?
Well, have you ever known someone who has fought with their management for years, deeply stressed, constantly trying to fix the toxic culture of their company, and then one day they just stop fighting? They become incredibly agreeable. They smile in the meetings. They fill out the pointless spreadsheets perfectly. They stop complaining. Management thinks the employee has finally bought into the company culture. But the reality is the employee has secured a new job that starts in 3 months, and they have emotionally checked out completely.
The compliance is not a sign of loyalty. It is the ultimate symptom of detachment.
Exactly. Bao Yu is filling out the spreadsheets of the Imperial exam. He's going to master their rules, walk into the examination hall, win the highest honors, hand the trophy to his family to settle his debt, and then he is going to vanish.
He is executing a covert escape right in front of their faces. And there's one quiet, beautiful scene during this period of intense study that betrays exactly what he is thinking.
Oh, the scene with Ying Er.
Yes, he is in his room, memorizing text, and a young maid named Ying Er brings him a plate of fruit. Ying Er is observing Bao Yu's diligence, and she is thrilled. She has bought into the illusion completely.
She chatters to him, saying that because he is working so hard, he is definitely going to pass the exam and become a great official. She tells him that if he succeeds, he will secure a great feat, and by extension, because she serves him, she will have a great fate too.
She is looking at the top of the pyramid and thinking it's made of gold.
And Bao Yu stops studying. He looks at this young maid, and he asks her a very strange question. He says, "What is your fate?"
Ying Er blushes, a bit confused, and replies, "We are just maids for our whole lives. What kind of good fate could we possibly have?"
And Bao Yu's response is the philosophical thesis of his entire journey. He looks at her and says, with complete sincerity, "If you can really just be a maid your whole life, your fortune is actually greater than ours."
That is just, it's brilliant.
I want everyone listening to just pause and absorb the absolute devastating irony of that line. Ying Er believes that to be a master, to have power, ambition, and the weight of the family on your shoulders is the greatest blessing in the world.
While Bao Yu, who is currently suffocating under that exact weight, realizes that ambition is a curse.
To be forced to compromise your soul, to survive in a corrupt hierarchy, to be required to traffic your own relatives or grovel for 50 taels just to maintain a facade, that is hell.
Bao Yu recognizes that Ying Er's lack of societal ambition is her shield. Because society expects nothing grand of her, she's not required to participate in the moral rot of the upper echelons. To live a simple life, unburdened by the terrifying machinery of success, is the true blessing.
He is basically telling her, you are so lucky you are not allowed to play this game. And the fact that he says this while his desk is covered in exam prep materials just highlights how deeply undercover he is. He is mastering a system he actively despises, purely to earn the right to leave it.